From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Goal Own Goal. By the lake, as always, the smiling assassin, Roger Mitchell. Hi, mate. How are you?
I'm good. Slightly sleepy. This is Sunday. We're recording this Sunday evening. Had a very, very big lunch today. You know, Lent is over, so it's catch up for the last few days. And just drank a little bit too much. So sleepy afternoon. Woken up, of course, with the United game, which was good. Did you see it?
I did. Yeah, really. Actually, really enjoyed it. I mean, I just had a feeling that Liverpool weren't going to win that game. Same as Fulham yesterday. They scored. They had too many chances. They didn't capitalize on, and then it never seems to work out when you do that. But good for the neutral. The title race is even tighter now.
We'll
see what happens. Now, when you say a big lunch, Rog, there's two types of big lunch, right? There's the big lunch where you've eaten too much, and there's the big lunch where you've been at the bottle too much. Which is it? Or both?
Well, you know me, I'm Scotty, so I'll always have a look at the comparison between the cost of a glass of wine and the cost of a bottle. And there was a mismatch financially today. So I said, look, it's better to just buy the bottle. And of course, once you have it, Rafa and I polished it off. It was,
Nobody can blame you for that. After 40 days in the wilderness, you're perfectly entitled to a bit of grub and a bottle of wine. Well, my friend, Goal on Goal is upon us once more. What have you got for me?
We all prep these and you see what... I've got a lot of small ones this week, which I guess with you could become big ones when we discuss them. But I'm going to start off with today's news that Berrettini, you know, my favourite Italian tennis player, he won the tournament, an ATP tournament today. He ditched her a couple of weeks ago. Boom!
Well, that did not He's take back. Long, did it?
He's back.
That did not take long.
And that's
so,
it.
So
that's
how many... he's been pretty appalling.
He's been shit since he was with her.
Now, for those people who are wondering what the hell we're talking about, just run us quickly through the story.
Extremely quickly, this is a showgirl in Italy that has a history of dating celebrities and especially football players. And then obviously Berrettini is a tennis player. And every time she does that, the athlete in question is plagued by a series of injuries and loss of confidence and loss of form, which she proudly in the past blamed on her prowess in bed. And it's as simple as that. So like everybody said, this guy got to the final of Wimbledon and was the big hope for Italian tennis. And he just fell off a wall. Started dating her and couldn't hit a ball. She's gone. He wins the tournament today.
And of course, in the meantime, Sinner has come through from nowhere to become the big Italian tennis hope, right? So maybe we should move on to him now, Rog.
Well, no, that's not going to happen. It's funny because, you know, in Italy, there's no element of, you know, filter of political correctness or anything like that. So there's a lot of commentators that have been talking and debating about what you exactly said there. You know, Sinner's come through, and okay, Melissa Satta wasn't mentioned, but has he got the head to keep it together because Berrettini didn't, you know? And, you know, he's fine. He's not somebody that's going to date a girl like that. He's a smart boy. He comes from a good family. Don't worry about him. That other boy, what was he thinking? Did he not do his homework? This is all on Italian TV. This poor girl, to be fair to her, I think she's taken some people to court. because they just said it. It's your fault. No, Italy just is still incredibly brutal about
Rog, now, I presume that was a goal, not an own goal. I can't quite tell.
That's a goal. I mean, look, seriously, you know, it's a goal because Italy now, I think, if you include Berrettini back in the game, as it were, Italy have got about three or four players in the top 10 or something like that. Or you know, like, so they are the coming nation in tennis. Look out for them.
Well, we'll
winners
see.
Of the holders
we,
of the Davis
we will
Cup.
See.
Yeah, we'll see.
We
what have you got?
Will see.
I've got loads of these small ones, but what have you got?
Good. Well, we'll get into a load of those. I don't have a lot of small ones for you, Rog, but we cannot have this conversation without talking about what I think is a huge goal, and that is the Premier League this year. And with, what, seven games left, we've got an absolute cracker on our hands. Obviously, when it comes to the Premier League title, I'm always a neutral, being a Fulham fan. But just watching what's been going on these past 3 weeks, looking at the results this weekend, looking at the result today, the Liverpool United game, which you always knew was going to be a potential tripwire for Liverpool. It's just terrific, Roger. So I want to get your thoughts on who you fancy for the title, and the three teams, because this is your wheelhouse. So let's do them alphabetically, and start with the Arsenal.
Well, I'm just trying to remember what I've said in the past because I don't want to repeat myself. But the new insight I think I would give is I am a great believer that these things at the end of the day come down to the team with the best defence. And Arsenal are just not conceding, never mind goals, they're not even conceding chances. They've got, you know, a great centre-back pairing with Rice and now Jorginho in front of them. He's come back into the team. They're looking very solid. And you know they've got a lot of threat up front. You know I'm not completely sold, to put it mildly, on Havertz. I still don't think, but you know he's doing well, and the Arsenal fans are loving it. You know, like I didn't see the Arsenal game yesterday, but Lucas said to me, "Oh yeah, Havertz has done well. He's played well today." And I went, "Oh no, oh no." You know, because then I said to him, let's have a bet to see how long it takes for the text to arrive. Elliot Richardson, within an hour. one line, it takes a big man to admit he's wrong. Exclamation mark. That's it. I'm not giving him that yet. I still think it comes down to the wire. I've told him this. I can see Havertz in a major situation, one-on-one, an easy XG opportunity to score, and I think he's going to bottle it. And that's, I haven't said that, I still think Arsenal, because of the defence, are the favourites. Liverpool, I just don't see it. You know, like, I looked around today in that team, and, you know, you can have one Jones, you can have one Harvey Elliott, you can have one Bradley, but that team's starting to get a wee bit too many of them. You know, and I don't see as enough game winners, match winners. You know,
are you saying in a Scottish accent you don't win anything with kids? Is that what you're saying to me, Rush?
No. I'm saying with average kids. No, I'm saying with average kids. This takes us on to another little mini bracket theme here, which is I think there's a lot of these young players that are very good now with what I would call just being good at the basics of the game, good athleticism, tactically, they play well, they cover well, they know the press, they know the counter-press, they'll put in a shift, they'll not let you down. I think there's a lot of these players like that, and the ones I mentioned a second ago are all in that category. None of them are world beaters. None of them are a young Dennis Bergkamp or an Andrea Iniesta. I think these players are disappearing. So I think you can afford a couple of these people that are the cogs in the wheel type player. But if you get too many of them, I think you've not got what it takes to get over the line. And you know, we discussed this before Klopp making his announcement that he was leaving. I said that would kind of hamper them. I still don't think they'll win it. And I don't think they were lucky today. I don't think that was a penalty. I don't think that was a penalty. So they were lucky to get a point in my view. City are an enigma, aren't they? You know, this whole Pep roulette thing. You know, I'm going to drop Foden after a hat trick and put on this one again and mess it around and change the back four and put Aki at left back and then put him at centre. The same with, you know, Guardiol, the Croatian boy. You know, Pep seems to want to do things kind of like showing off, and then his thing of, you know, having a talk with the players just after the game in front of the cameras and scolding them like he did with Jack Grealish. You know, something tells me there's something not working there. So I had a check on the odds on Arsenal 2 or 3 days ago, and it's 11 to 4. So if you think it's this three-horse race, that's a 100 to 3. Or 100 to 33, and I think, you know, Arsenal is going to win, but the odds aren't generous. Is that a decent summary?
It's a decent summary. I think Arsenal's run in is the toughest by far.
Yeah, it is. Right?
They've got to play Villa, Spurs, and Chelsea. All of those are landmine games for them. I mean, I think I would say they're the best team in the race. I would definitely say I would love them to win over the other two for sure. And yeah, it's funny what you said about the defence there, Rog. If you didn't see the game, you wouldn't have seen this, but with about 3 or 4 minutes left in the game, Brighton had a shot on goal, and Gabriel, great bit of defending, you know, pushed the guy to his right, hands behind his back by his sides, got his knee out and deflected the ball away from a corner. And the roar he let out, but saving that attempt, and the way that his teammates, you know, jumped and jostled and pushed him, you could tell what it meant to that defence to keep a clean sheet. To, you know, it was, they were 3-0 up and coasting. If that had gone in, it was not changing the outcome of the game. But they celebrated that more than they celebrated the goals. And I think there's something about this team. It's going to be tough for them for those three games. And I think that's why the results are, the odds are perhaps a little bit, I would say, longer, given it's theirs to lose now. They win every game, the title's theirs.
That's what I'm saying. The odds that I'm getting are not generous. I think if they're offering 4-1, I'd have a little tickle on Arsenal, but they're not. It's not a value bet.
There's one obvious potential cloud on the horizon for City and Liverpool, which is they both have to play the mighty Whites, and like, if they were in the bottom half of the table, I'd give them a good chance against us. But unfortunately, they're in the top half of the table. And we only seem to be able to beat teams in the top half of the table these days. It's absolutely ridiculous. Having sat with my dad and watched some abject football, after beating Spurs, we were pathetic against Nottingham Forest, dreadful against Sheffield United, and then dominated Newcastle. Had like 75% possession against Newcastle, you know, 15 corners to 2 and 10 shots to 3 and lost 1-0. It's just, you know, the perils of being a Fulham fan. But this, you know, look, Rog, I think regardless of all that, this title race is absolutely terrific. You know, whether you like the clubs or not, there are three phenomenal teams here, you know, who are 10 points clear of fourth place, 1 point clear of the three of them, and it's going to go down to the wire, which I just can't wait for these last 7 games. You know, we haven't had a year where every result is going to mean something from here on in, and I think it's going to be just a cracking last couple of months.
Yeah, and I've got, you know, talking about Fulham, is it not simply just, you know, I could ask you, what are your boys playing for anymore? You know,
no, you're right, but they were, the Sheffield United and Forest games, they were so bad, Rog. I mean, just weren't
not,
on the.
It was.
Look, you saw we made 3 subs after half an hour, right? I mean, it was embarrassing. And you know, you're right. They're on the beach already. All those old cliches. But had they won those 2 games, you know, a finish better than last season was possible. And last season, everyone had said was a great season because everyone predicted we'd go down. It's just frustrating as a fan, you know, when you watch this stuff and you do what you do against Spurs, where we batter them. And then you got Sheffield United and Forest coming up, and you think, oh, here we go, 6 more points, this is great. And then, you know, it's one thing to lose, but to lose playing like that.
Although I probably this isn't popular, but I do think that, you know, the style of football that goes these days is getting further and further away than the one that I personally like. You know, it is extremely athletic. You know, if you see these subs coming on, standing, just waiting to come on, they're huge. Everybody is a physical specimen now, you know, strength, speed, good engine, tactically, you know, works hard off the ball. That's all great, you know, sure. But I don't see, like I said, the kind of like Roberto Mancini, Zola type players so
the
much
Pat
anymore.
Pat Nevins. Shout out to Pat.
Shout out to Pat. And you know, that everybody will say, oh, that's just old man talk, but I genuinely see that, and I can feel why that's happening. That, you know, when the academies are working and boys are at 12 and 13 and 14, the bigger boys look better, look stronger, look able to win games easier, and the talented, maybe smaller lads are sidelined, don't get the coaching at the right moment of their development, and are lost to the game. This is an old theme about coaches of academy teams. Their incentives, always coming back to Charlie Munger, their incentives are to make some kind of impression with their club. And the way to do that is to win the Academy Under 15 Cup or the Under 16 Cup. So they want to win, as opposed to their main role being developing talents for the club and maybe even losing. That they're, in my opinion, they're not interested in that. This is an old chestnut in football. But the more and more the game has become athletic, I think we're starting to see the fruits now. You know, Messi's retired, Ronaldo's retired, Iniesta's gone, Xavi, even Neymar's 30, Dybala's 30. I don't see a lot of people coming through. You know, I play fantasy, you know, so I'm looking a lot. I don't see people that say, my God, De Bruyne is the one that I think is maybe, even he's 30. Do you know what I mean, Grant? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do, Rog, but I think... you'd have to say that the overall quality of football on display in the Premier League is just terrific. You know, even the games between the teams who are struggling at the bottom, it's a hell of a spectacle. I mean, the gap between the Premier League now, top to bottom versus the other leagues there's no one else in the hunt for me. You watch Luton play Bournemouth or Luton play Sheffield Wednesday, United, and these are terrific games of football. With heart and passion, and they're fighting for something, and the skill level, even at the bottom end of the table, is light years away from what we grew up with. So I don't know. I get your point, but I don't know that overall it's necessarily a bad thing.
Well, you know, it's fine to have a different opinion on that, and you know, everybody says, "Oh, the game's so much quicker now, so you just don't realise how skillful they are to do things at the speed that they're doing them at." Whereas the boys that I liked in the '80s and the '90s, they had loads of space and they could lord it because there was nobody up their backside. Anyway, that's a big debate that you never get through. One of the things I did have that on the Arsenal game that I picked up after the Arsenal game. It's just about people and brand. And we've talked about this kind of thing with people that are nothing to do with sport, old colleagues from the finance industry that you and I, you know who I'm talking about, we won't mention them here, who has gone on. Actually, there's two of them now that I think about that have gone on to have a kind of like public persona as, as macro kind of like giants. And you don't like that. Well, I mean, I look at somebody like Ben White, right? I quite like Ben White as a player. And, you know, I ask Luca, I say, is he any good? He says, yeah, I think he's good. I think he's a good player, so I trust him. But I look at Ben White and he's got to be careful. You know, first of all, he's got that whole tanning thing going on, you know? That's for a... You know what I mean there. That's edgy. That's kind of like borderline. Then he says no to England. Whether he's right or wrong, whether he's been treated well or not, not a good idea in the eyes of the fans to not show up for your national team when they come calling. Never a good idea. And then yesterday, he goes down like a sack of potatoes when nobody touches him. You know, how long does it take for your brand to go to shit? You know? And I always wonder, who's advising these boys? You know, like if there's, whether it's his manager, Arteta, or his agent, or his father, or brother, or wife, or whatever it is, take him aside and say, look, Ben, you're doing really well. You've had a good 2 years. Don't mess it up thinking that, you know, you're George Michael from Wham. You know, don't mess it up. You know, do you know what I mean? And anyway, these things annoy me. I mean, Jesse Lingard, you know, he's now, you know where he's playing now, Jesse Lingard? FC Seoul.
Okay.
Right, so he's in Korea, And I think that's via Turkey and one of the teams there.
Yeah, Turkey. I remember, I was with him until Turkey and then I lost him.
Right, so the owner of FC Seoul casually, en passant, comes out this week and says, Jesse Lingard can be a good player, but if he's not going to run like the others for 90 minutes, he's not a good player. Now, if I'm Jesse Lingard and I've got that kind of talent, to have some nobody owner of a team in Korea chastise me like that, I would do my head in. I could not take that. You know,
Rog, hang on a second. Jesse Lingard, what is he, 47? Jesse Lingard is no spring chicken. No, he's not.
Let's have a look. Keep going.
We're going to go to the Google. Keep going. Talk amongst yourselves. I thought he was in his late 30s.
What?
Certainly over 35. How old is he?
Jesse Lingard.
Here we go.
Born 1992. He's 32.
Oh, all right. He's 30. Yeah, so, all right. Fine. I thought he was older than that. Who am I thinking of then?
Oh, it's a selection of them. Dele Alli, all of these, Balotelli.
I can't think what I'm thinking of now. Anyway, okay, all right, fair enough. I thought he was a lot older than that, so I stand with you. My comeback, had he been that old, was like, what's he doing still playing? Like, what are you doing needing to play in FC Seoul? I mean, he's not doing it for the money.
It's embarrassing. It's humiliating.
And if he is, something's gone horribly
wrong. Guy with talent. Yeah, anyway, these are my pet peeves about seeing people piss it all away. It really is a pet peeve. On the other side of that, if you allow me, these are all my little ones all coming together in a narrative now. Nicolas Fonseca, I told you about him a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, you did. Your neighbour.
My neighbour who was playing in the Clásico because he was finally signed by River Plate after a really tough time in Italian football. Horrendous injuries, wasn't treated well here, went across the other side of the world, hard yards, living in Uruguay, did well there, then signed for River Plate, scores this amazing 35
absolute worldie.
He can't walk down the street now. And it's so pleasing because I've told you this before, he is a lovely guy. If you see the interviews, because there's a zillion of them now, He's got this fresh face, lovely lad, you know, the one that the mom would like the daughter to bring home, you know, that kind of thing. And we were speaking to his mother, who obviously is still our neighbour, and she's from Naples and she is a character in herself, really intelligent lady. Incredibly good-looking woman, she said, "You know what? You know," she says to Rafa, more Rafa than me. She says, "You know, when he was having his tough times here, you were the ones that were always nice to him and saying, you know, keep going. You never know what's round the corner." And others were kind of like laughing and saying they'll never make it. They'll end up playing in the supermarket team. Now that he's doing this, she's got all these people coming up to her, giving her the compliments. You know, and she's saying, you know, his life is just unbuilt, especially small parochial towns. You know, like all these people come up now. Oh, your son, I'm so pleased. This is great. I always knew. And like being from Naples, she can see through anybody. They know. And she's just looking at them saying, I know. You don't know. I know, but I know. And I'll never forget. Anyway, Nicolas Fonseca, I really hope. Yeah, no, because you could go up further from there. River Plate is already a huge, huge achievement. But
massive, right?
I looked him up on Transfer Market, and because, you know, that's the kind of player. It's coming back to another big theme, Grant, about the Premiership. And you see, when you watch a game, you see, oh, he cost 95 million, Mason Mount cost 60, and all that. And you're thinking, my God. You know, you could get Nicolas Fonseca, I think, for about 3 million. And he is not 10 times worse than, you name it, any midfielder.
Anthony. 20
times.
Anthony, 85 million.
So you know what I'm saying? There's got to be a moment in this industry of football, Grant, that they start thinking about value for money. It's another argument. But Nicolas Fonseca, 35 yards, unbelievable. And I'm so pleased.
Yeah.
Sorry, I monopolised that.
It actually ties in nicely with one of my goals, which I want to get to, which is the article I think you shared with me, but I think I saw it in The Athletic as well, about Como FC, FC Como, whatever they're called, the James Horncastle article. it was just a fantastic, you know, and having been there and seen the stadium, and Franz and I snuck into the stadium to try and do some filming down there. You know, you couldn't sneak into Old Trafford or sneak into even Craven Cottage and with a camera crew and just do some illicit filming. But A, what a wonderful article, and B, what a fabulous story. And rather than, I mean, we'll post a link to the article in the Twitter threads. But I'd love you to walk us through what's happening there, Rog, because it the story is just beautifully written. But it is a great story.
Yeah, it is a great story, and it touches many aspects, some of which we could debate all day, because how this ends up, we don't know. There's every element of this you could argue both ways. Como traditionally in the 80s and 90s was always a top division team and had some great players. And I remember seeing them.
Wait, 80s and 90s, looking at the state of that stadium, you're talking 1880s and 90s.
Well, the stadium's never changed, but you know that. That's a problem in Italy, and this is part of it here. So if you give me some time, I'll try and remember, because obviously I've got some insight in all of this. So they're now owned by an Indonesian billionaire, multi-billionaire, tobacco billionaire. You know, like Indonesia is the last great cigarette
proper
market.
Billionaire.
You know,
proper yeah, billionaire. You know what I mean? This guy.
You know, like
he can buy and sell Abramovich.
Yeah, yeah. The cash is flowing. It's not on the stock market stuff. You know, the cash is flowing. So they've bought it, and you know he hasn't thrown money at it. He brought in. There's some elements of this that you just think this is bizarre. He brought in Dennis Wise as his director of football. Dennis Wise now. Not doesn't strike me as somebody that's got director of football CV written all over him. You know, what's that thing that, you know, the thing in golf you say, I've got a Dennis Wise.
Yeah, a nasty five-footer.
A nasty five-footer.
Yeah.
So Dennis coming to a country that's not his own, not speaking the language, you would not bet that he's going to be a great director of football. And yet... I met Dennis, a lovely guy. He didn't know who I was. Why? How would he? Super nice. He would just treat me like a normal bloke. Fabregas is here. He played Fabregas. He brought everything up. And they've got a Welsh manager. A Welsh manager. You know.
Owen, I can't think of his name, but yeah.
And he's got a great backstory as well. And they've just done the old-fashioned team building thing. Adding little pieces as they've come up the leagues, because they've come up all the leagues, you know. But not
Wait, you've forgotten Thierry Henry's involvement as well. Don't forget him.
Yeah, yeah. I hadn't finished the story yet, so we're now in Serie B this year in Serie B, and the first two top teams go up automatically, and then as a whole playoff thing. So you want to get into the top two, and Como's sitting in second. And yesterday, they had a difficult game down in the south of Italy, very difficult to win in the south of Italy, especially in the second division. Lots of things happen down there that you never know. You never know how the game's going to go. Sorry, anybody, but they all know it's true. You go down there, you know, like you got to cross your fingers. They're 1-0 down at halftime. You think, okay, classic. They're not getting anything from the south. And they turn around the second half and they win 2-1. And, you know, they win 2-1. That's a huge result away from home, and they solidify their second place. Bottom line is they're going up, Grant. I'm convinced they're going up. They're going up. And so the town here is all about, of course, in Serie A, we're the richest club there is. Yeah. You know, the fans are already there. Our guys get more money than everybody else put together. Forget Redbird, forget the Chinese guy at Inter, forget the Agnelli family that's got not two pennies to rub together anymore. We've got the smoke guy from Indonesia. Keep on! So listen, I'm at the game and I'm speaking to them because they invited me to go. And I'm saying, you know, like, as I said, look, you guys are going to go up, so you got to tell me what you're going to do with the stadium. You've seen where that is. It barely can, there's no parking, there's nothing. It's just is beautifully on the lake, but there's nothing. There's nothing, and it's obviously it's fallen down. It's a Meccano stadium. They've got so much work to do to it. And they said to me, "No, we've got a plan. We've had all the big stadium people, and they said them all the big ones, IMG, you know, Elevate, all of them. They'd all been there to come and all put their plans together, and the city's in with them as well."
I said, "What does that mean?" Just so we know, do they have the same kind of rules that Trip Luton up, i.e. they won't be able to play Serie A games until that stadium's got a certain X, Y, Z?
Ish. It being Italy, there's grey areas, but ish. You know, but they know they're going to have to do serious work to the stadium, which they will do. And I said, okay, great. And I said, it's going to be on the current site. You're not going to... No, the current site. So this new stadium is going to be on the lake, which is magnificent. Most beautiful location in the world. And I said, what about the parking? He said, well, we'll knock the school down. I said, what? I said, well, because there's a school right beside it. There's a primary school there right beside it. I said, what? He said, yeah, that's the deal with the Comune, with the local council. You know, they let us knock the school down and we build a multi-story car park, also underground, for all the parking. And we build them a new school somewhere else. And I said, okay. You know, like, it was the kind of answer you say that this is what's happening. He wasn't stumbling. He knew what was happening. And I thought, okay. So anyway, you know, it's even more than that in Como, because the women's team, completely separate organisation, completely separate, is the first acquisition of Mercury 13, that fund that is about investing only in women's football. It is run by Vitoire, just an Argentinian woman. I met her in London, just wonderful, wonderful person. But, you know, like I say, next year, Champions League, that's got to be the objective. Top four. Boom times for Como.
Spectacular.
The serious point of it is that Como is the archetypal sports tourism club. So what the idea is, apart from, you know, doing what you do and maybe becoming some kind of like Udinese or Atalanta, that kind of thing, selling club and doing it well, is that you link it to what is a booming tourism market and which is Italy's strong point. So you get the families coming over, you put a package on for them, you maybe take... Forgive me if this is sexist in any way, but you take the mothers and the daughters down to Via Monte Napoleone in Milan to do shopping on the Saturday, the husband and the sons, whatever. You know what I mean? Whatever the family nucleus is, there'll be things for all of them to do. If they don't like the football, they can go up on the airplane across the rate, all that kind of stuff. So sports, tourism via football clubs, Venezia's doing something similar, Venice, Florence, obviously, if they can get that stadium built. That's the future, I think, for Serie A. They can't compete, as you said, with the Premiership in terms of money, but my God, they can compete in tourism, which that's the future. Sorry if
there's no football. There's no football tourism in Grimsby or Stoke, Rog, that's for sure.
Don't think so.
No, I don't think so. Fantastic. That story in The Athletic was really, really well written. And
he
just
wrote it well, James. Yeah, he's a good lad.
He did a really, really good job. All right, what else have you got for us?
Well,
I kind of threw my goal onto you there. We've got you to do most of the talking. But anyway, carry on.
That's right. Well, I'm going to throw it back then to you then, because one of the things I wanted to talk about was tribalism in sport. You know, the Caitlin Clark thing and the article I did today.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up, so I'm glad you did.
Well, so this is what I'm going to prompt you with, and then off you go. This is what has come all around my head in these days. And it's a five-year dynamic, you and I. I've been telling you for 5 years that sport is content. We need to compete with content. The kids don't see sport as different. And you've said no. And I would say in the last 6 months, certainly maybe longer, I've come more around to your position, that we can never really win a battle if we just think we're competing with TikTok. We just can't. TikTok and its algorithm is just too good for us to ever compete, no matter how good we get at short form, no matter how good we get. So you think, well, we need to double down on what our strong suit is, which has always been your point. But here's my thing. What doubling down in our strong point is for me, for football anyway, is tribalism and a bit of nastiness and a bit of edge. And I think, okay, fine. And then I think, but this society we're in doesn't like any of that. It's actively trying to kill all of that. So even there, they're not letting sport compete for attention on its strong points, because our strong points aren't nice, politically correct stuff. A lot of it is incredibly edgy and close to the line. So that would be my prompt to you, Grant.
All right. All right. I'll pick up on that. So you're right. Everything you said is absolutely correct. However, I think there is an important however here, Roger, and that is ultimately, you know, we've talked before, you and I, at length about the various pendulums that are swinging all over the sporting landscape and how many of them are reaching their apogee and starting to swing back the other way. And I think this, what you wrote about this morning, and it was a fantastic piece. If anyone hasn't read it, they should read it. Go to albacchiara.net and read Roger's latest piece, because it's terrific. And it lays this out perfectly, Roger. Without the tribalism, what is it? You know, what is sport? It's pure tribalism. And it's been funny, this weekend, the US, obviously, I'm watching US TV here, and they have, they show every Premier League game in the US. You watch them all the blackout games at 3 p.m. You can watch every single game. And this week, they had one of their fan fests, which is they go to a town, go to a city, and it's a live weekend. They have all events on, and everyone goes there to watch the games. And they have, you know, they had Alan Shearer there this week, and they had a few, you know, non-football, but big, Mo Farah was there, who's a big United fan, apparently, and blah, blah, blah. But it's a big in-person live event. And so you've got the camera swinging around. They've got the drone shots, the whole thing. And there's thousands of people there. They're queuing up from midnight to get into this thing. It's a big deal. And the crowd is just littered with small pockets of supporters wearing the shirts of every club, United, Liverpool, Arsenal. I saw two guys there with Fulham shirts on, but one of them seemed to be trying to sell his shirt to someone else. But they're all there. Every fan is there. They're all in it. And you've got the Liverpool-United game today. So the Liverpool-United fans have obviously been kind of hustled to the front as the backdrop for the pre-game stuff. So you've got all the fans there. And they're rabid fans, Roger. I mean, they've all got all the kit. They've all got their signs. They haven't just shown up out as a curiosity. These are hardcore fans. But the proper fans, they're properly excited. They know the players. They know the team. They know the history. And they're standing right next to a Liverpool player, putting their arm around him when, you know, they've beaten. It's, oh, good game, well played. Right? So it's all that. So there's none of that edge. And the edge doesn't transmit overseas, because it's local, it's tribal, right? It's Manchester and Liverpool. That edge is only going to be there for the hardcore fans in the stadium, in the cities, and even, you know, even the Guildford Man United fans, you don't think they get really upset at a Cobham Scouser, do they? I mean, they don't, you know, it's like, oh, we hate them, but they don't really hate them, right? And it's funny, you know, I was chatting with our mutual friend JC yesterday, who's a big Celtic fan, but he's also a Man United fan. And I was saying, well, you know, obviously it's tough for you, because you don't want City or Liverpool to win the title. I mean, you know, I don't know which one's worse. He said, oh, United. He said, Liverpool. Without a question, Liverpool. I can't have Liverpool winning it. So, oh, that's interesting. I know the rivalry is strong, Liverpool and United. But you'd really rather the noisy neighbours won another title, their fourth in 4 years, and consign most of your records to the history, the dustbin, than see the Scousers. And he goes, absolutely, absolutely. I can't stand the Scousers, blah, 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 blah. It's real. And I said to him, where does that go back to then? Do you know what he said? You can probably guess.
No, I can't.
They took King Kenny from Celtic back in 1977. That was the genesis of his animus for Liverpool, right? But you know, and I've been a Fulham fan, Rog. You know, we can't stand Chelsea, we can't stand Brentford, we can't stand QPR, because they're local rivals. But it's not hatred, right? It's not. I mean, I'm sure the hardcore Fulham ultras, all six of them. And they're the guys who, when they drink cups of tea, they keep that little finger down. They don't bother lifting the little finger up. That's a Fulham ultra for you. I'm sure they have something deep inside them that really detests these teams, but it's not visceral. There are only so many clubs in the world that have that real deep-seated hatred for each other. And you obviously are a fan of one of those, Celtic Rangers. And we saw this, the Old Firm derby this week, another cracking game for the neutral. But how did you experience that 3-3 draw with the hated Rangers? Right, I mean, it must have been horrendous for you to lose a 2-0 lead and then, you know, see the 2 points go away. So I think there's a place in the game for that, and it's a very real part of the game, but it's a very localized thing. So I think it's not such a problem, Roger. I don't think that travels, and I don't think it translates into the broader game.
Well, the article wasn't just about football. In fact, the core of it was around Caitlin Clark and Angela Rees,
yes,
I think her name
it was,
is.
And we'll come on to that for sure.
Well, you know, the point was that in a WhatsApp group that had been formed by young Andy Marston, an excellent thing, there was a discussion about why this women's basketball game had been so successful in terms of appeal and TV ratings and everything like that. And everybody had their opinions. And then, you know, the discussion went into, well, the actually more obvious opinion is that one tribe is representing flyover mid-America white, and the other one is mainly black, coastal, which absolutely mirrors the identity politics that's in America just now with Biden and Trump. And I said, that's what the appeal is. You know me, I don't sugarcoat anything, and this is the point of the article. When there's an element of real edge, in this case it's serious edges, it is proper tribes, so that's when sport works best. You know, Roma Lazio, Celtic Rangers today, Liverpool. I had a guy on LinkedIn who replied to my article, you know, LinkedIn, lovely article, and all the things, you know, love it. Last line, we've got the Manx scum today and we're going to do them. this is a professional guy yep. on LinkedIn, you know, yep. like, and I thought, yep. Jesus. But anyway, my point in the whole article, I can't repeat it all here, but I think football as sport has got a big future as long as we realise that our biggest, strongest suit is the nastiness. And I hope our modern society of political correctness and woke doesn't kill the golden goose.
But, Ross, this is where the pendulum becomes so important, right? Because you're absolutely right. The Caitlin Clark thing, there's always going to be haters for anyone who's successful, right? But it's a really easy narrative to hang an op-ed piece on, right? She represents Trump, MAGA America, and they're sick of all this and they're sick of all that. And it's very easy to hang that on it. At the end of the day, it's not, I don't think it's necessarily real. And what we've seen with this pendulum stuff, and I kind of got a track, and this is where I was going to hopefully end up eventually, and here we are, is demonstrated perfectly by your countrywoman, J.K. Rowling, this week, right? And I have so much admiration for this woman. It's extraordinary what she's been through. And there is, for anyone listening, sorry, I think we may have talked about this before, but if we haven't, I cannot recommend this strongly enough. There's a podcast series called The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling. And everybody should listen to that podcast series because it lays bare what she's been through, but also, more importantly, how this whole thing works, right, about outrage and what you're not allowed to say. And I think that, Rog, if you ignore it, right, it does go away. The problem is we haven't ignored it. You said in your piece, right, sticks and stones will break my bones and names will never hurt me, which is what we learned growing up. If you went to your mum and said, hey, he called me this, she'd say, it's just names, get on with it, right? That's the reality. We all know that's the reality. People get bored of saying things that don't get a reaction. All that's happened over the last 20 years is that reaction has been amplified, given oxygen, and the minority of people who are offended by these things are made out to be the most important people. And the truth is, names don't hurt, right? They just don't. It's just not that way. And J.K. Rowling this week basically dared this ridiculous Scottish hate speech law that's been put in. And fair play to her, she came out and she dared the police to arrest her over it. You know, she's like, I'm going to say this, And what she has to say is inarguable, right? You can have an opinion about it, but she's not wrong on any of the facts. And what was interesting was how quickly both the Scottish police and Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, came out. The police said, we're not going to arrest her. And Rishi Sunak said, she's got every right to say that. Do you see how quickly that died down? You see how quickly that whole thing kind of disappeared? And if you follow her Twitter thread, you'll see all these people come back at her, and her straight bat knocking them all back to the boundary, every single last one of them. And very soon it goes away, Rog. And that's where we are. We're now, I think, at the point of the cycle where people go, look, we can't fix everything you're upset about. We can't stop you being angry about this and about that. And I think sport is going to be the same way, Rog. I think sport is going to be the same way. You know, the tragedy chanting, which, you know, we all know is awful, but the more oxygen you give it, the worse it gets. If you leave it inside the football ground, to your point, it's one lot of supporters screaming at other supporters. And the point you made in your article, which was just absolutely terrific, is when you cross the line, the people behind you in the crowd go, oi, cut it out. You're crossing the line. And that's the way it should be left. The whole thing is self-policing. So I think this is going to start becoming less prioritised, Rog, sorting out all the nasty things that people say in football grounds. And when people start saying, I want to report to the police, someone called someone a name in the crowd at Nottingham Forest yesterday, the police are going to go, yeah, all right, we'll get right on that. Thanks very much. And ignore it. But what's interesting about the Caitlin Clark thing is, there's been a whole bunch of WNBA players talking smack to her about, yeah, you're killing it with the college kids, but wait till you get in the WNBA and you start playing against real players and blah, 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 blah. And somebody put on Twitter today something which I think is absolutely right. They said, I really hope that Caitlin Clark goes back to Iowa for a senior year, makes $20 million in image rights, and then quits the game, marries her sweetheart and lives happily ever after, right?
Because nobody gives a flying fuck about the WNBA anyway.
That's you saw the Bill Burr thing that I tagged you on, right?
That's the irony of it all. And you know, I'm not as optimistic as you, because I still think there's a lot of people that are scared to death of calling it as it is. You know, and you're absolutely right.
They're getting braver, Rog.
I don't see it. I still see a lot of people playing this diversity. You know, we must do that. How can anybody argue against this? All of this stuff. And you know, I genuinely believe I am one of the most progressive people you can get on the male side. I really am. I just don't like being told what I need to do. And I don't like quotas. But there are still a lot of people that haven't got the lateral thinking, and they are desperately submerged in groupthink, and they cannot get out of it. You know, I was in another group recently where, you know, I won't go into the details or people know what I'm talking about, where somebody said to me, look, you know, fair point, but could you make that point privately to a person in the group, you know, rather than, you know, publicly, could you do it at DM? I left the group. You know, like there is such a low threshold to offence and triggering.
Right, Rog, but this is the point. You've just made my point entirely, right? One person asked you to make that point privately. Did anybody else in the group complain about it?
No.
Right, that's my point, right? You left the group. Why? No one else has got a problem with it. One guy, you left the group because this one guy is upset about it. Just say, no, sorry, I'm going to say it in public and, you know, no harm done.
It wasn't even in my usual style. It was normal. It was normal.
Right.
But there is an element.
But no one else
of...
complained, Rog. And when you play up to this guy and you say, oh, I'm going to leave the group, you leave it for one reason, in disgust. He leaves it thinking, oh, the bad apple's gone. You just say no. And more people are going to say no. And more people are going to say, no, I'm not going to leave the group because
I don't want to personalise about me, because I'm a rather strange character and everybody knows that. So I'm not a good example.
Do.
Yeah, yeah. I'm you know, this hate bill in Scotland. You say it's all gone. She called their bluff. I'm telling you, we will see what happens. We will see what happens there. And you know. I'm just not as optimistic as you are, Grant, and I dread the we try and get rid and out of sport all the things that make it different. Which, if you do put sport into this famous competition analysis of where it sits in the entertainment world as content, all we've got is the thrill and the passion that is all coming around a little bit of edge and rivalry. That's our USP, to put it in business terms. And the woke people want to take that away. Intellectually, strategically, business-wise, it's the most stupid. It's like the transgender thing I put in the article. Absolutely killing what everybody wants, which is women's sport to succeed. Transgender's killing it. Everybody knows that, from Navratilova to Chris Evert to, I mean, the number of people that are coming out and saying that now is increasing, you know, but no.
To my point,
well,
I'm not comfortable being the optimist. I'm not comfortable being the optimist in any situation. If I'm the most optimistic person,
let's get back to these people when they're right, because they are right sometimes.
Well, we'll see.
No, this is funny. They're right here in this one. The Spanish guy, you know, the FA guy, the one that kissed the girl, the one that won the World Cup.
Rubiales, yeah.
Yeah, this is so funny. I got it. This is so funny. You know, I picked this up. I think I got it in the FT. I always like to give credit from where I saw stuff. I think it was the FT. His chief of staff, who is his uncle. Now, there's the red flag straight away, right? You know, in any part of the world, you know, his uncle's chief of staff apparently has shocked him on two or three things. Starts off with a kiss, right? Starts off with a kiss, and now he's been charged.
Wait, who's saying embezzling that? Started with a kiss, hot chocolate.
Yeah, good call,
his new theme tune.
That's a great...
Yeah. Go on.
embezzling FA money to throw bunga bunga parties at his villa. Now, Luis Rubiales at this point is moving up the scale of interest.
yes, exactly right.
You know, like he's moving up the scale of interest. Like, so he's taking money off the FA, which, let's be honest, is not that unusual in sport, that the guy at the top is kind of like putting something in his pocket. Not that unusual. But the bunga bunga thing is rather special, so we've got to give him some points for that. He also apparently is accused of having taken money from the Saudis to move the Spanish Cup final to Riyadh.
Yeah.
So he's in trouble now.
Colour me shocked.
Yeah, colour me shocked. Right. He's in trouble now, and this is how, so like, all the people that say sport is male, pale and stale, full of misogynists, full of people that are, you know, got wandering hands and everything like that, They're right here. They're absolutely right. But the interesting thing for me, Grant, this is, I love this stuff, right? See if you've been in that position that you've got the bunga bunga parties and you're used to women like being at your beck and call. That's why he made that mistake by kissing her. That's why, because your filters, your sense of moral code has been dropped by too much time of screwing around. And I think that's how I rationalise it. Great story.
Oh, you need to share that, because I haven't seen that story. I saw that he was like been threatened with a number of years in jail, but it said
for
the kids.
I'm like,
I didn't realise it was for all that stuff. Okay, that makes a lot more sense.
There's other stuff. I mean, like, I saw something. You know, you saw the article today where, you know, it goes back when I once saw a European Leagues meeting. I may have told you this privately. It was either the Greek League or Macedonia League or again, Turkish League or I don't know, Cyprus, something like that, that part of the world. And, you know, these are just classic talking shops. You go there, the host is leaving you little gifts at the table when you go, the little tie, a little, you know, bottle of port or something like that. And you talk about how the world is difficult and why we have to protect the clubs here and UEFA there, and it's especially the European leagues. It's a total waste of time. And this guy comes in. I'd never seen him before. I'd been to two or three. This guy comes in, very fucking like Zorba the Greek. I mean, like, it was Anthony Quinn. He was a big guy, Grant. He was a big guy, and he was distinguished, grey hair and everything like that. And he's got these fucking massive rosary beads round his neck, not the normal ones. Like everyone looked like
lottery balls. Like lottery balls.
Yeah, like golf. And so, like, it was fucking huge. And, like, so he comes in first, and I thought, well, that's pretty striking. And behind him comes two of his assistants. And I'm telling you, I'm talking Claudia Schiffer, you know, like, one and the other. And what the fuck is going on here? And during the meeting, he's moving the beads, you know, as you do when you do the rosary.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's welcome to European football, governance to die for. One of them would have been the chief of staff.
Yeah, right. Oh, man.
Listen, let's finish a little bit with, tell us a little bit about golf. You're going to the Masters, aren't you? I know you don't like to say that, but you're off to the Masters.
I'm going to the Masters, yeah, next week. Cannot wait. It's just
tell us a little bit about it. You're taking one of our mates, John Colquhoun.
Tell
us about the whole Masters experience, because none of us have been there.
Rog, look, you can't really tell anyone about it. It's everything you would imagine it to be and more. And there aren't many things that you get this level of excitement about that deliver over and above, right? You tend to get so hyped up about these things and you get there and it's never quite as good as it is in your mind. But the Masters is absolutely not that. It's better in every way. And I've been lucky to have been to a few, and the thrill does not diminish in any way, shape or form. You know, there's something truly magical about it. It's not just the venue, which is pristine. It's not just the way the thing is run, which is flawless. It's everything. It's the food and drink. It's the respect for the game. It's the respect for the place. It's the fact that you won't see a piece of litter anywhere on the grounds the entire time you're there. It's the fact that there's an unwritten rule that you're not allowed to run as a patron anywhere. And I don't ever remember seeing it written, but I've never run because no one else runs anywhere. It's just, it's a cathedral, Roger. It's, you know, you as a man of religion will understand this cathedral atmosphere of being somewhere of reverence. And it's just magical. And you know, things have kind of worked out in a very roundabout way. And so JC is going to come with me. And, you know, JC's been around the world of sport for a long, long time, right, at the very top levels of sport. Top levels. And he's a terrific golfer and loves his golf as much as he loves his football. And the fact that he hadn't been to the Masters was surprising to me, because you would have thought the chance would have presented itself at some point in the last, you know, 40 odd years, but it hasn't. And not only that, but he'd been trying to go for ages, and it just so happened through a whole set of circumstances that I can take it with me. And I'm so thrilled to be able to do that, because I remember the first time I went, and even though, as I said, the thrill isn't diminished, to be able to witness him seeing it for the first time is going to be quite special. But yes, I'm looking forward to that. But there was one more golf thing that I wanted to talk about, Roger.
Can I just read out the JC thing before you go on to that, because it does come back to what we're talking about, sport and its USP. So John, when he heard the news, I didn't know you two were doing this, and I know it was pretty much, you know, serendipity and everything like that. He writes to me, I know we're supposed to be super cool and nonchalant about these things at our age, Roger, but I can't play that guy. I am so excited. Life feels good just now. That's a DM of a 10-year-old, you know?
You know? It's exactly right. And do you know what, Roger, the best part of it is I will see his face at every point in the time we spend there together. And I know he's going to come away, as excited as he is in those texts, he's going to come away on a whole different level of how good it was, which is just, it's just wonderful to be able to, you know, to experience that with someone, you know. But as I say, sticking to golf, you probably wouldn't have seen this. Did you see Jordan Spieth yesterday at the Texas Valero
Hacking Open? Away and hacking away somewhere.
Well,
I saw him at
it's
18.
Not, yeah, exactly right. If you just saw it, you saw him in the middle of a bush, you think
Twitter,
he's hacking away
somewhere. I saw Twitter thing, yeah.
Right. So what happened is he's hit his ball and he's dead. And Spieth does this a lot. I mean, Spieth has made pars from places that you can't even believe they're actually part of the golf course. But he's in this spot, he's got no shot, he's got rocks all around him. The only shot he's got, which his caddy, he asked his caddy about this, is to hit it onto the roof of the clubhouse, because then he gets a free drop into an area where he can get back in the game.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
Yeah. So you see him take this massive swing and he's aiming sideways and he hits the ball onto the roof of the clubhouse. So he gets a drop. There's a drop in a certain area that'll give him a chance to get back in the thing. And I'm conflicted about this, right? I'm conflicted about this. There's a part of me that says that is terrific presence of mind from him and his caddy, thinking, oh, we're dead here. What can we do? Well, if you hit it onto the roof of the clubhouse, you get a free drop and you're back in play again. And there's all these people on Twitter saying, what a cheat. It's absolutely despicable that he's doing that, getting really, really pissed off at him. And I'm like, I come down, I'm like, you know what? In that situation, to have the presence of mind to understand that if I hit it onto the roof of the clubhouse, and he asked his caddy, Mike Grello, he said, well, where do we get dropped? He goes, yeah, back out sideways. He goes, all right, I'm going to do it. And I come down with the whole presence of mind to think like that in the moment and not just go, oh, I'm dead here, I've got no shot. I'm like, way to go, Jordan. Way to use the rules. You know, they're very clear. If you end up on the roof of the clubhouse, here's your free drop.
Let me ask you, because of what you just said earlier about Augusta. Do you change your mind?
Here's the thing, Rog. It's a great question. It's a great question. However, at Augusta, they don't put up a temporary stand around the 18th green every year, right? It's not. It's people sitting there in their chairs. There really aren't any of these corporate hospitality boxes that are in your line of sight that they put up to make sure they can maximise the amount of corporate spend. It's just not there. It's a very different type of golf course.
Let's assume you had the choice. You called it a cathedral earlier. You know, you don't want MD heading it on to St. Peter's in Rome, the golf ball. You know, it's the same thing. You wouldn't say presence of mind.
This is my own conflict, Roger, is that I've thought about this exact thing. Going around the Masters, going around Augusta National in that tournament, there is nowhere that this is going to be an issue. It's not going to happen there. If he gets up and down from there with losing one shot and wins the Masters, what do you do? On the one hand, you say, fair play. On the other hand, you know that his Masters jacket is always going to have a little asterisk by it in the minds of true golfers. And that's the way it should be, right? It's the people who, there will be people who go, well, he's, you know, that's never going to stand for me. Doesn't matter. His name's going to be on the trophy. He's going to have the green jacket.
Let me ask you a question, because we've seen a lot of Augusta clips on social media these days, which are all great. Scott Hoke missing that. How do you live with that? You know, like Doug Sanders and St. Andrews. How do you think at our age now, Grant, we reconcile living with that for the rest of your days? I don't think it's funny.
Yeah, it's funny. I've read an article not that many years ago, but old enough, but long, far enough ago for me to have kind of forgotten the detail of it. But it was talking to Scott Hoke about exactly that. And he said he can't. He basically said,
You take that to your grave.
Of course you do. And probably, I would think, as a golfer, no matter how you rank the majors in terms of importance, but missing a short putt like that to win the Masters versus wishing a short putt like that to miss any to lose any of the other three, the Masters has got to be the one that hurts the most, simply because of the things that come with it. You know, the lifetime membership to Augusta, you're playing in the Masters for the rest of your life. The whole thing that comes with it is brutal. And it was
the locker.
I mean, it's a treacherous green, but it's. I mean, it was that right. It was
less than 2 feet.
Yeah, it was horrific to miss that putt.
And I watched him line up the putt. I mean, something must have happened to his brain, because his feet were absolutely nowhere in the right position to make a good stroke at the putt. You know, I think his brain had already told him, you're going to miss this and I'm going to place your feet in a way that makes that happen. Because you look at his feet, they're nowhere parallel to the path of the putter. You know, it's just like they're almost at right angles.
Well, look, some people with those short putts open their shoulders a little bit so they can look down the line better. Let's not go down that road. Either way, he missed it. Faldo wins and the rest is history, right? I mean, it's extraordinary what happened there. But hey, anyway, we'll be there, JC and I. Look out for us on the TV. You probably won't see us. Look out for us anyway.
There's we've got a wee bit of time left, and but not enough time to go into this fully. But there is a really big point about us talking about one of the majors and its independence and its glory in the middle of all the shambles that is professional golf these days. Augusta is sitting atop this like on Mount Olympus. It really is. And, you know, we all need to reflect on this, because if you look at tennis and you look at Piff and Serge, there's no secret. There was another great article in The Athletic again about, you know, what is basically the breakdown of the investment of Saudi Arabia into tennis, both men's and women's. They were hoping to merge them. And somebody had told me 2 or 3 days before that article came out the reality of the shambles that was going on there. And then it all came out in the article, and this person said to me, look, the leaks came out immediately, right? Which is about, you know, the different governing bodies, the majors, Gaudenzi, the Italian, trying to have a power play, a land grab. The Australian boys were not up for that. You know, the difference between, you know, men's and women's amounts, CVC in there somewhere. And I think the Saudis, and we know those guys well now, they just said, listen, too hard, you know. But the reason for talking about that is that the majors in golf and tennis have got to decide what they want to be in life now, because they've got the power to be anything they want. They can break away, they can do their own thing, they could join together as a new company, the majors, you know, and just basically leave the rest behind. Do you know what I mean?
Well, they can't do that, Rog, unfortunately. They can't do that because the PGA of America own the PGA Championship. So, and the USGA own the US Open, and the Royal and Ancient own the British Open, or the Open Championship, as I should more correctly call it.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, apart from the PGA, I take your point on that one, you go to the RNA, you go to the USGA, whatever it is, and you go to Augusta, and you just say, look, we're going to be the majors, and you create another one if necessary. You know, what I'm saying is, this is the kind of thinking I'm sure is going on now, because in the tennis world...
They don't need to, Rog. They don't need to, do they? They've got everything they need. They've got more money than they can think about. They've got the prestige. They've got, you know...
I'll tell you the reason why.
For those three of those four, it's nothing to do with the money and the... Nothing to do with it.
I know, but it's the calendar. I think it's the calendar. And all of these things, cricket as well, let's throw that in as well, it's the calendar. My understanding about the tennis thing is that the Gaudenzi wanted to do more ATP stuff that ran into what was going on at the start of the season in Australia, the Australian sweep that leads up to the major in Australia. And the guy in Australia, this is in the Athletic article, it's as if I'm knowledgeable, I'm just repeating what's in that article. This is the thing, you know, like these majors exist around a moment in time that goes a little bit beyond just their tournament. And if other people, like this big theme in sport, always trying to get more revenue, get more product in, the World Club Championship, by the way, anybody know what happened to that? Did anybody follow it? Oh, do you know what I mean? All this stuff, the majors, you say just be passive, you don't need to do anything. I'm never a great believer in that strategy. I always believe to get out in front of it and make sure that what I want, either as my own major or with the other majors, you know, friends, is what happens before other people take some money.
Well,
but
they've done that, Roger. Don't forget, they've done that in the last couple of years, right? I mean, they've actually changed the PGA Championship now so that you have the Players' Championship in March, the Masters in April, the PGA in May, the US Open in June, the Open Championship in July. They've got that block of, which is prime golfing season, they've got that locked down now. And I don't think that's, you know, they try to make the Players the fifth major and include it in this thing. They moved that thing from May to March so that they had room to bring the PGA Championship from August up into the rotation. And the Players' Championship this year demonstrated exactly what a disaster this whole PGA Tour Live thing is, because you had what golfers desperately, the PGA Tour desperately wanted to be the fifth major, and they've lobbied for it to become the fifth major for years. And there's no Rahm, there's no Koepka, there's no Johnson, there's no... It doesn't matter so much in the major championships, but it matters a lot to the Players' Championship, because that's the tour's flagship championship. So it's, you know, and we've seen since then, and we'll save this for another time. I was going to talk about this week, but we're way over time. But, you know,
the stuff this week with a lot of the Liv players coming out and saying, well, we need to get the best players in the game back together again for the good of the game. And, you know, it hits differently coming from Rory, who didn't go for the money, than it does when Bryson DeChambeau says it, right? There's very little gravitas that Bryson DeChambeau can complain about, saying, well, I want to play against the best in the world. You left to chase the money, and now you want to play against the best in the world, which means you want to be back on the tour. So golf's in a complete shambles, and
that's my point. When you're in the middle of an earthquake, I believe that you work out where the safe ground is before, and not just hope that you're safe just now, because the ground underneath you now that you think is safe may change. So the tennis thing, much more than the golf, I know that this is going to be a big thing now. I'm going to end with an up note, as I like to end with an up note. Athletic Bilbao won the Copa del Rey, the Spanish Cup, this week.
Yes, I saw that.
You may have seen the footage from where the final was, I believe, Seville, or you may have seen their own stadium, which obviously only had big screens on it, that was absolutely sold out massively. Athletic Bilbao is something we need to celebrate for the reason that you know, we've talked a little bit about before, about tribes, about financial sustainability, about the pathway for younger players. They're a Basque club, you know, for people. I think most people listening to this will know where the Basque region is in Spain. It's about 2.5 million people. They only play boys from the Basque region. They're only playing local boys. And they won the Spanish Cup. Now, it's not that they're a small team. Bilbao's always been a great team. But, you know, we need to celebrate those scenes that we saw there. That this region, this club, has put together a tribe that had a great success this weekend. And it points to a lot of the direction that we should grab hold on. But the other side is clubs like PSG or the way Chelsea's going just now. Let's look at Athletic Bilbao. So.
Yeah, terrific. Terrific. Hometown victory. All right, matey. Well, I guess that just about wraps things up
for
another week. Boy, does the time fly. Thanks, Ross, for doing this. It's always been fun. And, of course, our thanks, most importantly, to you out there for listening to us. If you listen and don't follow us, what the hell are you thinking about? We're much better on the written word than we are in person, so you should remedy that by finding us on Twitter. You can do that if you search for @entertainedR. That's the word A-R-E. If you want to follow me, for some bizarre reason, you'll find that it's pretty easy to do as well, @TTMYGH.
And you can follow me @RPMCuomo, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Forza Como, Rog. Forza Como.
Forza Como. Forza Como. Take care, Grant. Stay safe.